Gavin McCormack, welcome back to the podcast.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Ash.
No worries. And if you want to go back and listen to the first episode with Gavin, it was episode 47. But I wanted to get Gavin back because I've been following his journey, particularly on LinkedIn, to his recent trip to Jumla in Nepal. And it was very inspiring. And I wanted to get back, or Gavin, sorry, I wanted to get Gavin back on the podcast just to tell the story about what he actually did. So, if you don't know, I'm going to hand it over to Gavin right from the start. I'd love to hear about how the journey came about and pretty much take us through what happened, mate.
All right, well, look, thanks for having me. And if any questions come up while I'm talking, just interrupt me because I can have a tendency to just rattle on for a very long time. These things are they're amazing. So I don't want to miss anything out, but if anything comes to light, just jump in. All right, is that fine?
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So look, I've been working in Nepal for a long time now. 2016 is when I first started going there. And really, it was quite interesting because everything that could go wrong in the initial trip went wrong, horribly wrong. But it turns out in the end that it was a miracle because it set me on a path to something very cool. I was actually studying to be a Montessori teacher, and I was on my final prac when you do a practicum every year, and I was doing a 4-year diploma. And in the last year, I just put into my supervisor, like, hey, is there any chance I can do my last prac in Nepal? I just thought, should definitely say no, but if you don't ask, you don't get. So I put it in, and she said, look, it's a bit abstract, but have you got a school lined up there? I said, yeah, I've got a school lined up and everything. And she said, okay, it's approved. You can go there for 6 weeks for your final prac. So I'd been in touch with the school teacher there, school principal there, and I packed all my bags, took 6 weeks off work, and I was heading there for this practicum. I knew I was going to Nepal, like I know I've been there before, but I wanted to see the mountains and all that cool stuff. And on the way there, I stopped in Bangkok to change flights. And so I just messaged the guy on the way there saying, hey man, just a reminder, my plane lands at 10 o'clock and hopefully be at the airport. And the guy wrote back saying, I'm so sorry, it's been a huge mix-up. Our school's closed for 2 months. I've got the dates wrong, and I'm not even in Nepal anymore. So I was like, oh my God, I've just taken 6 weeks of my final prac. Like, what am I going to do? So literally, I went on Google in the airport, and I just went to the second person who came up on Montessori when it came to education in Nepal, and I pinged him. And then I got his number. Within 10 minutes, he'd replied on Facebook Messenger. And I called him, and he said, "No problem. I understand where you've got an issue. Don't worry. We run a training center here, and you can come and do your prac here instead." And I was like, "Okay, I have no idea what I'm getting into here because that set all the other thing up." And I went there, met the guy, and the guy was just a lovely, one of the most beautiful guys I've ever met in my life. In fact, this is like my family now. His name was Anand. His name is Anand Devkota, and I did the prac with him. I called my supervisor and she was like, it's all good, totally fine, as long as everything's kosher. And off we go. And in that time when I was with him, he said, come down to my village. And I live really rural near the Indian border. And you can, see my family. And I was like, okay, I like to say yes to things. So off I went. And I went to a village, and there you go. It was just really rural, border of India. And they were like, no one ever comes here. It's just dust and buffaloes and houses made of cow poo and just beautiful. It was just beautiful. Like, it was, I just thought, wow, like this place is insane. And I went to visit a local school there while I was there. And when I walked in, I was absolutely horrified of what I saw. It was basically it looked like a prison cell. It was just dirt on the walls. There was a bit of carpet and there was kids sitting on the floor and a lady called Padma, I never forget. And she, I said, what's going on here? And she said, oh, it's a school. I said, like, this isn't a school. You don't have anything. Like, where's your paper? Where's your books? Your tables? There's nothing. And she said, we don't have anything. The kids come here and have one. She had one notepad that she wrote on, and the kids just kind of sat around her. Anyway, when I saw her situation, and I cannot put a shelf up in my house. I'm so bad at DIY. It's unbelievable. Yeah, I'm good at teaching, but I'm not good at DIY. But I just said to her, like, you know what? I can't let you teach like this. So I'm going to come back and I'm going to fix this place for you.
Sorry, get what year was that when this happened, when you went there?
What year? 2016.
2016, yep.
10 years ago.
10 years ago.
And so I came back to Australia, and at that point I was a school teacher in Balmain in Sydney, and I went to my class with the pictures of her school and I said, "Look, guys, I found this school. It looks like this, and I want to fix it. And I'm not sure where to start really, but maybe you've got some ideas." And the kids were 9 and 10 in my class. And the next day a kid came in, very next day, and he had a little pack of colored pencils, and he'd taken them from his bedroom and he'd wrapped them in an elastic band, and he had a little note and it said Nepal. He said, "Gavin, I brought these in for the kids in Nepal." And so I put them on the floor in a little cardboard box, and I said to the kids in our class, "Look, this is what's happened today." Within a month, I had shoes, books, pencils, most of the materials, coloring things, everything, jackets. The mums were knitting clothes. People were raising money in the community. I ran a Sydney half marathon. I went back to that community with a few thousand dollars in my pocket and all the stuff the kids had collected. And I flew it all there. I went back to the community. I said to the lady Padma, "If you don't mind vacating your school for the weekend, I'm going to fix it." And it was only one room, so it wasn't a big job. So I closed the door, kids left, and I got a couple of volunteers and we decked it out. We painted the walls, we put carpet in, we put shelves up, we put all the materials there, and the kids came back. And when Padma walked in the door, she started crying straight away, just huge tears of joy, and all the kids were just there. And it felt so good. I can't tell you how good that felt, that moment. It's like some kind of existential realization that you exist on this world. And also, you've got this amazing ability to change people's lives. So I got addicted to that feeling, of course. And for the next, I don't know, 7 years, I went back 2 or 3 times a year and built schools, libraries, teacher training centers using the same model: raise a bit of money, collect some things, fly there, a school, can you help us next? And you go visit the school, and it's like a train. But then COVID hit, and we had 2 years we couldn't go there, which was really sad because we couldn't leave the country. And then the year after, we opened Up School, and Up School is an entity in itself with tens of thousands of teachers. So it's hard to get away sometimes to do that stuff. But what happened in that journey was really interesting because there was one man, his name's Manarishi Dittal, and he writes and edits the biggest newspaper in the country. It's an online newspaper called The Online Khabar. And if any of your listeners are Nepalese, they will know him. He's famous there for his work in the community and in the media. And it's very good source of media because it's all authentic, it's true. And he'd always helped me throughout the years getting stuff into Nepal, because when it comes to customs, it's quite tricky sometimes. There's a lot of paperwork and bureaucracy, and he'd always like give a call and help me get things through customs and all this kind of stuff. And he'd always said, "One day, Gav, hopefully you'll build a school in Jumla." Now, I've been to Nolpanassi, Chitwan, Kavre, all these places in Nepal, and they are semi-rural, or in Australia you'd call them very rural, but in Nepal they're not rural. But Jumla is rural. So I'd often looked on the map of where it is, and your listeners can go on Google Maps and just type in Jumla and see where it is. And it is remote, and that is like saying something. So I often put it off. I thought, "God, it's just maybe I can't do it. It's too hard." To get all the stuff to Nepal is one thing. Getting it to Nepal, then Jumla, is another thing. So, I just thought, "Look, I'll just do it." So I messaged him and said, "Look, I think I'm good to go. Show me, is there a school in Jumla you can send me some pictures of?" So he sent me these pictures of the school in Jumla. I don't know, on your podcast, people can go and look this up and, type my name and Jumla, they'll find the video. And what you see is this school on a mountain. And I call it a school, but really it's just like two concrete blocks. And they're up a mountain, an hour and a half hike from a river in a glacial valley. And there it is, this two concrete blocks. And inside, the pictures I got were children sitting on dusty floors, little tiny, bits of carpet, no shelves, no books, no pencils. Some of the kids have no shoes. But what was really daunting was the children had lost their families. So all of these kids, or most of them, I think there's 70 kids and 59 have lost mum and dad. And they live in a little, a kind of shack round the corner from the school, and that shack is made of mud. It's got a roof, but there's holes. They sleep on planks of wood with little blankets, three to a bed, and they're taken care of by a couple of adults in the community who are very beautiful people. And it was devastating to see those pictures. And I don't know how you feel, but when I see something, if I see something on the news or something on the internet, I'm just connected to that thing, although I know it's real. But when my friend, who I know, sends me a picture, this exists, and I'm one step away from that. I can't now know it exists without trying to do something about it. I'm like, well, okay, I have to do something about that if I can. So, I didn't like what I saw, and I felt really sad about that. So I put it out there on the internet, on LinkedIn, and a beautiful man called Mr. Kota Prasad. He runs Medipack over in Bankstown in Sydney, which is an organization that makes vitamins and minerals that you buy, and magnesium and calcium and these kind of things. And he wrote to me saying, look, I want to help. I've seen the pictures. I want to help you. So we met for a coffee in Sydney, and he said, how much will it cost, this job? And I said, look, I really don't know, but I've done this before. And I reckon for 20 grand, we can get it all fixed, sorted. Tables, chairs, books, pencils, 10,000 books shipped there, the whole shebang. And so he was very kind. And he said, look, I'll pay for the shipping of the books, because I've took 10,000 books that I've collected in my garage. And whatever is left over from that, I'll chuck in up to 10 grand. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. Thank you so much. That's really kind. So we shipped the books, and then they landed in Kathmandu. Manarishi Dittal helped me get them through customs, and he went to my training center, which is in Bagbazar in Kathmandu, and I followed straight after on the flight. And then it started. So, I've raised money over the years, and I had a bit sitting in a little kitty, and I put a bit of my own money in there, and we bumped it up, and we had enough money to pull it off. But let me tell you how it works, just so your listeners know. So you land in Kathmandu, and Kathmandu is a bustling city. And on the first couple of days, you've got to get organized because you've got a lot to do. Jumla is 3.5 days solid driving from Kathmandu.
Three and a half
So
days. Okay,
3.5, yeah.
got a question quickly. But okay, imagine that, like from Kathmandu to Jumla, it's just a
Yeah.
straight road, and you go say 100 kilometers per hour the whole way.
Yeah.
Would it take like a lot less? Because I'm gathering that there's some real like interesting road
Yeah.
and terrain.
It will take you, it's about the same distance to drive from here to Canberra. So 2.5 hours in Sydney to
Oh,
3.5 days in
yeah.
Nepal.
Yep.
And it's one of the most dangerous roads in the world,
Wow.
alongside the one that everyone knows in Bolivia.
Oh, yeah.
So
Seen
we'll come to the road in a minute, but yeah, it's hardcore.
it.
You suddenly realize your fear factor is like on maximum level. So the first couple of days, you've got to get organized. So you've got all this stuff. You've got 10,000 books. It's a lot of books. And the kids have nothing. So don't have any tables, no carpet. You need all this stuff. So you go around Kathmandu for a couple of days, and you've got this pot of money to spend. And you go to a local market and you say, all right, I need these tables. And you find the tables and say, can I have these tables? I need 70 tables like this. And the lady goes, we've only got 20 of them. I said, well, how quick can you make 70 of them? And she says, oh, 24 hours. And you say, all right, great. What's the price? She tells you the price. Good. And then you haggle and you get it down a bit, and you tell her the work you're doing and how it'll be in the national newspaper. So she comes down a bit lower too. And you
Yeah.
say, now I need a truck with them all on the back. And I need to go to Jumla. We need to go on a convoy. She's like, oh my God, Jumla? And you say, yeah, I need to get to Jumla. And she's like, okay, well, it's going to cost XYZ. So you line all that up and then you leave. And you say, thank you so much. And you pay the money and off you go. And then you're like, well, now I need material. I need pencils. I need books. And I need containers to put the pencils in. And I need XYZ. So you go to the next warehouse and you say, okay. And you make a deal. You get all the things and you tell them Jumla. Oh my God, not Jumla. And you say, yeah, Jumla. And can you put it on a truck? And he's to meet us at this checkpoint, and we're going to drive there together. And so you do that for a couple of days, and you line up all the stuff you need, and then you set off. And so, me and the guys get in this Scorpio Jeep, and off we go. There's four or five trucks driving together. And you leave Kathmandu, it's a bit chaotic, and then you get down to, at what they call out of the valley, Kathmandu is in a valley. You get out the valley, now you're in the mountains, and so there's landslides, and the road's really precarious to the point where at some points of the road you've got like a 2,000 meter drop off of the side, and there's only enough room for one car to go. There's not enough room for two cars, and you go around the corner and there's just a bus. There's just a bus coming your way, and you're like, how are we possibly going to get? We
Oh my God.
can't, like, we cannot get past this. This
Yeah.
is going to be physically impossible. And then what happens is the driver, who's like done this 1,000 times, like, all right, guys, I'm just going to edge over towards the edge a bit, and the
Right.
wheels are going to go off a little bit, but don't worry, the bus is going to scrape against the cliff wall, and the bus is filled with like 50 people, and then your cars are rubbing against each other. You're on the edge, and you're looking over, like, oh my God, it's like a sheer drop into like a river down there, and it's all crumbling. It's not like with
Yeah.
barriers and stuff. And then you slowly nudge by and off you go, and he floors it and off you go, and you're up in the mountains. And it's continuously like that, day and night, pitch black, dark, driving through fog. It's just like, it's insane. But after a short amount of time, you start to really trust this guy because you realize he knows what he's doing. He's done this, he knows the road like the back of his hand. So eventually you get to Jumla, and you're sleeping in the car. There's no accommodation and stuff like that, and but it's amazing. The view is just astounding. Got mountains and snow-capped peaks everywhere. It's just astonishing. And we get to Jumla, and then the driver drops all the stuff off, and then it's time to get the stuff up the mountain. Now the driver's not going up the mountain; it's just not possible. But you've got tables and chairs and books and all this stuff. So then, the bottom of the mountain, you have to find a local farmer who owns a tractor, and this tractor has a trailer that takes goats and buffaloes, up the mountains, and slowly but surely you load all the stuff onto the back of the tractor, and he takes it up this really precarious road, and you all hike up, and you get to the top. And when you get to the top, the first time we got there, all the kids knew we were coming. All the kids were waiting for us. They'd been chattering in the village that these people were coming and they were going to fix up our school. And they have this beautiful ceremony where they clap you in. They're all clapping, and they clap you in, and they put tikka, that red dye, on your hair, and they put scarves around you, thousands of scarves, which are really nice. And then we go and have a look at the school, and the school is worse than you see on the pictures. Like, it's not great. There's just dust on the floor, and it's just horrendous. And then you set the wheels in motion. So the community, which is amazing, they all want to help. Everyone wants to help. But what's amazing is the kids really want to help because they've naturally never painted. They've never painted before, never seen a paintbrush, never touched a paint, never seen a book. Like, it's really shocking. So that night, in the nighttime, I got a pencil and a torch, and I went around every classroom, and there were four classrooms in this particular school. And I sketched out mountains and hills and rivers and scenes of space with planets and Earth and asteroids flying through the sky. And I'm no artist, I'm just a primary school teacher. And the next day, and when the kids come and all the adults who want to help, I get all the paint that I bought and I mix it into different colors. And just so you know, like, how difficult it is, we bought all the paint, and all you need is prime colors. You can make any colors you like. But typical as typical is, I open all the pots and all the prime colors are missing, and they're all just pale pinks. And yeah, they're all the wrong colors. The guy in the shop has just mixed the wrong colors. Like, oh God, this is not great. Anyway, you make do with what you have. And so I mix the blue, and I get these kids together, and I say, look, this is the sky. I'm going to put dabs of blue where you're going to paint, and you're going to paint your own school. And they're like so excited. They're painting their own school, and I'm, setting all the adults off, and you're going to paint the outsides. This is yellow. Here's your yellow. And they're painting the yellow outside, and all the community just working. I'm just some kind of site manager. Anyway, I'm helping too because it feels good. And over the next couple of days, we're painting the school. Well, I've got these local carpenters building shelves 24 hours a day, all night in pitch black dark, with like iPhones, to, not iPhones, but phone torches, so they can see what they're doing. They're soaring all night and making shelves and just hammering. And, and we're all, when it gets dark, we're all heading down to the village to go to sleep. And the next day, just starting again. And it's -6 at night time.
Oh,
It's freezing. And, but it's beautiful. It's like beautiful. And all the chatter starts to happen in the community that what's happening. And, the local state minister comes, and the head of the military turns up, and they all want to have a look at what's going on here. And the school, this particular school, had been forgotten. But suddenly everyone knew it existed now, and they were all paying attention to it. So the project's going on, and we're in it for 4 or 5 days, and it's starting to look really, really cool. And then something, I'd say probably the most poignant moment in my life, maybe, I'm not sure, one of them happened where, and I'll really try not to cry on your podcast, but if I do, I can't help it. It's just the way I am.
Yeah, absolutely.
We unpack all the boxes for the library, and we're putting them out on the shelves, and the kids are so excited looking at these books. And many of them speak English because they've got a guy in the village who speaks English, actually, and he's been teaching them, so they can read and they can speak a little bit of English here and there, and they're very excited. But after we've emptied all the books out, we've got all these cardboard boxes, like hundreds of them. And so it's really dark and one night, and it's really cold, and so we say, let's have a fire. And normally we don't have a fire because they don't have anything to burn. So we said, let's burn the cardboard, and we'll get some of these leftover wood that we've got from the shelves, and we'll have a little fire. We'll keep warm. We'll stand around. So we did that, and we're all standing around a fire, and stars are out. If I can paint a picture for your listeners, it's beautiful. You can see the Milky Way. The Himalayas are there. It's just nuts. And we're having a fire. And this girl, she's 14. She says to Manarishi in Nepalese, can I sing a song? And he says yes. And she starts to sing this song, and I won't ruin everything by trying to put on her voice, but it was a sound never heard before, ever in my life. It came from like the throat. It was kind of like a Mongolian throat singing, gargling kind of thing. And it was in Hindu. And it was really one of the most beautiful sounds I've ever heard come out of a human being in my life. So we stood around and she sang this song. And when she'd finished, I was like, wow, that was really. Jeez, that was the most amazing sound ever. And maybe the atmosphere of the stars and the mountains made it even more emotional. And I asked him, what's the song about? And it was like hard to hear that. I remember going to bed that night in tears, and then the next day just crying again when I just thought about it. And basically, the girl was 14. She lives in that shed I talked about earlier on. She goes to this school, and she lost her dad very early on in her life, and she only had her mum. And one night, her and her mum were walking through the valley looking for firewood, and a tree fell and killed her mum in front of her. So she lost her
God.
mum. So she ended up an orphan, and she lives in this orphanage with these children, and goes to school. But when I heard what the words were, it was like really heartbreaking. So she wrote the song herself, and the words go something like, mum, I miss you, and I've lost you, and la 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 la. But the words are, even though the sun shines, I can't feel the heat. And even though birds sing, I can't hear the sound. And there's no love in my heart. Blah, blah, blah. I can't say anymore because I'll start crying. But God, so devastating to know that. And, to be right there with them. And then I just start to think, like, how much disparity there is in terms of what we've got in the world. And I look around at what we all have here. And we take for granted. And, I'm not a rich by any means. And I don't know about you, but there are some very, very rich people in the world who could literally click their finger and every single child would have a school or have a place with a roof which doesn't rain on them in the night at minus 10 degrees. And it was just heartbreaking. Anyway, the next day I went to talk to her and I had a translator and I said, I'm not going to let you sleep in that room anymore. It's so terrible. I can't let that be. And your song was so beautiful and it made me cry. And I tried to talk to her, but I started crying again. It was really bad. Anyway, it's fine. So we'll go back and we'll fix up their sleeping arrangements. That's my next project. Anyway, getting on to a more positive note, the next day was the school opening, and the minister came, the head of the military came. There was like, I don't know, 500 people there. Children came from every village. All in the mountains, they wandered in, to come to see what had been happening. And we cut the ribbon. The kids went into their library and into their classrooms. And I'd say the best moment for me was I got to go into this room, and it's on LinkedIn, this infamous room, which looked so horrid. And now it had a carpet, a red carpet. All the walls had mountains painted on them and birds and clouds, and there was a shelf filled with materials, with pencils and books and everything they needed. And there were tables that they could sit at. And I welcomed the kids into the class, and I had the privilege of teaching them their first lesson. And it was just a most amazing 45 minutes of my life to see. And the lesson wasn't anything. I taught them how to draw a lion on a piece of paper, but they'd never seen a piece of paper. They never held a pencil before, you know? So like the magic of that with them was just brilliant. And then, you know, to finish the story, you know, I had to leave eventually, and it's really heartbreaking to leave because by that time you're so deep in the emotional, you know, journey with this community. And even though you really can't speak to many of them, you're just hugging the adults, and at night you're saying good night to them, and they're bringing you tea, and you know, you're looking at each other's eyes, and you really feel connected, and you've got to leave. And that it's heartbreaking to leave because you feel so like entwined in their community and as one. And but I said this last night to somebody that, you know, it just feels so good to do that work. The feeling is so good. And yeah, I just love doing it. I just wish I could just do it all day, every day, nonstop. Maybe it would lose its magic if that was the case, but feels good doing that, and working with the community so they feel that I didn't just some white guy turning up with cash and building us a school. It's like, hey, we're building a school together. It's not, I can't do it. In fact, I don't know how to do anything. I don't know how to put a shelf up, so I'm really going to need your help with this. But the results, you know, are just brilliant. You look back and just feel so happy that you were able to do that. And you can't do it alone. There's a lot of people out there helping along the way, people collecting books, sending them to me, raising the money, supporting along the way. And people like you online are like, you know, even those little comments people write, you know, like they're just so motivating. And the idea, you know, some people are negative online. They're like, oh, look at you, so ego. It's all about you. And yeah, I'm fine. I can take that on the chin. It's not really about me. What I really want to do is, you know, allow other people to think, oh, I want to do that. You know, a lot of people say that. They say, I want to do that as well. Can you help me? I say, sure. You know, like I'm happy to help you. So, you know, there you go in a nutshell. And in a few months, we'll be back, and I'll be building them a new place to sleep with carpets and bunk beds and lights and heating. And I can't leave them like that. So yeah, all good. But yeah, that's the story in a nutshell. You probably got 1,000 questions.
No, that's amazing. Like when you like were telling that story about the 14 year old girl around the fire and how I lost her mum and dad, and like I was actually like got quite emotional. Like I know we're on audio only, but it was tear was going down my eye. So you probably had two fully grown men in tears looking at each other on camera. But oh mate, yeah, a lot of questions and oh, I guess. And I just interesting to hear what you say there, like about the comments about most of them are positive, but you get the odd one, oh, you're doing it for yourself. Like that's depending on the way you look at the world, isn't it? I see you can, as you say, you don't do it for that. You can actually you share what you're doing to hopefully encourage others and help do the same. And that's the way I see it. And like, and I was, yeah, I always thought like, what can you do? Like, I'm just trying to think which direction. You know, when you get there, I've got a question about that. You mentioned about when you got there, like you had like some money that you raised and the generous gentleman that you met with in Sydney before you left. But how do you know? I guess you've been there a lot, but because you didn't have actually a lot of the resources until you actually got there, and you hadn't even organized a lot of them. So, what do you do? Just rock up at a like I don't know, like a business and just ask for that? Yeah.
That's right. Exactly what you do. I mean, I've done it many times now, so I kind of got a ballpark of what it's going to be. And you know, Nepal is a lot cheaper than Australia, so your money goes a lot further, of course. But yeah, I mean, you never really know. I mean, I don't mind. I don't mind if I have to spend my savings. I do that. It doesn't really matter. You know, like if I was going on a luxury holiday, which I never do, I should do that one day. You know, you spend money on stuff, and you get to feel good about that, right? So I just think, well, I'll spend my money here. I still get to feel good, but at the end, all this thing happens. You know, there's tables and chairs and books and stuff. But I have some trusted people that I've used a lot, and I go to them. You know, I've used them loads now, and I turn up at their warehouse. And when I turn up, their smile is like, "Oh, he's here. He's going to spend 5 grand." But they're lovely, and they always give amazing discounts. And you know, they're looking after their own people. But going back to your initial comment about the people, and do you do it for yourself? Well, the truth actually is, you do it for yourself a little bit, because
Yeah, I know what you mean.
you get a feeling, you know, you get a feeling out of that. You're doing it for that feeling, of course, but you're also doing it because it's the right thing to do. So it would be a lie to say, oh, I'm doing it just for the people. That's not true at all. And no one acts like that at all. Our biochemistry rewards us for doing good stuff. So you get a dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, floods your bloodstream, and probably why you cry, because you feel happy about what you're doing. You feel emotional about that. So there's always going to be a few negative nannies kicking around. But like keeps things in perspective, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with the I guess the next project, like that you mentioned about how you the plan is to go back and help build the, I guess, the sleeping facility or whatever, I'm not sure what you
Yeah,
call it.
we're calling it a hostel.
Hostel, yep. So what's the process for that? Is it, can anybody get involved? Like, how can people help out if that's a thing, or is it all sorted? What's the next steps?
So probably all sorted. So there is an organization in Nepal called Agurka Eco Panels, and what they are, they're like a imagine like a thin bit of chipboard with a concrete inside with metal rods going through, and it clips together like a jigsaw puzzle. So basically, they build buildings, and you put a roof on top, and they're earthquake proof. So if there's an earthquake, it doesn't fall down. It just kind of wobbles a bit, and that's a big problem in Nepal, especially in the mountains. You don't want the school falling on the kids while they're asleep. That's the opposite of what you want. In fact, I'll tell you this, which is really interesting. When the earthquake hit in 2015, that 7.8 magnitude, the huge one, a lot of schools collapsed on that day because they were badly made or made out of brick. But Saturday is a school holiday in Nepal, so no kids were in school. So it's like a, thank God it was on a Saturday. I mean, I don't want it to be any day, but if it was going to be any day, then Saturday was a good day. When I went there, I looked at the school building and I thought, let's put them on top of the school. It's already got a concrete slab. It's got the iron rods there. Let's just build them a hostel on top of each of the buildings, one for the boys, one for the girls. And so I've already made all the plans. I've put it out there, and I've got a couple of companies in Nepal who are already put the you know the they put a bid in to say, we'll build it, we'll transport everything, we'll build it, we'll if you can come and help us build it and paint it and set it up. And all we're going to do, buy bunk beds, get them shipped out of China over the border into Nepal, and Bob's your uncle. It's amazing actually now, because this place doesn't have electricity. So you're like, well, it could be a problem. Well, it's not really a problem, because now you can buy these tiny little wind turbines and a couple of solar panels. And Bob's your uncle. All the kids have got light and they've got heat, in a room. And these things are cheap as chips now. So for 20 grand, they'll have a place to sleep, all the kids. And I feel happier that 14-year-old and who lost her parents doesn't have to sleep in the freezing cold, three to a bed on a piece of wood. And it's no one's fault, it's just the way it is. But if you when you know when you see when you've been there, I have to go to bed at night, and I've put my air conditioning on and my heater, and I've got my cat, and I'm reading a book with a lamp, and I'm like, I know they're going to bed also, but I know where they're going to bed. And if I can have any kind of influence in changing that, then I definitely will, and I am going to 100%.
No, that's so inspiring. And I know this is not the first project you've done in Nepal, but I think with it, is it fair to say this is this, I'm not sure, I'm not going to answer for you, but is this one of the, I guess, most rewarding, or is they some
Yeah.
have, I guess they have some, everyone,
Yeah, it is. It is the most rewarding because it's the most difficult, and I'd say it's the greatest month of my life since I've ever been alive. Really, I loved every single moment of it. I didn't want to leave in the end. I actually th was like, oh, I'll just teach here for the rest of my life in this school. One night I was thinking that. But it's very cool, and the world is so small now, and everything is easy, it's accessible. And to anyone out there who's like, oh, thinking about doing something like this, like, I would say, just get on a plane and go and find your way. And it doesn't have to be Nepal, it can be anywhere. And it will work out. You'll work it out, along the way. You'll do a little project, you just become slowly bigger, and you end up becoming a master at it. And then before you know it, you can literally do anything. So, as they say, 10,000 hours and you can master anything in this world. And I mean, thanks for having me to talk about it. I mean, it's been a really cool journey, and hopefully, just as long as I can walk, breathe, continue to do it. So, yeah. But one thing you said before, when you said, can anyone get involved? It's interesting because I was at a Montessori. I was out with my Montessori Australia team last night. We went to the Opera House to watch a show as like our annual get together. And afterwards, one of my team members was like, "Hey, I'm really interested in coming with you to Nepal. That project looked unbelievable. I watched the video." And I said, "Oh, it's not easy." And she said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I'll just tell you a couple of things and see how it sits." And she's like, "Okay." And I said, "Well, number one, there's no running water." And she's like, "Oh, that's okay. I can take a water filter." I said, "You can." I said, "Well, number two, there's no toilet paper." And she's like, "Oh, okay, that's a problem." And she said, "How do they wipe their bottom?" And I said, "Well, left hand is for wiping and right hand's for eating." And so that's the way it goes. That's why a Nepalese person will put their hand behind their back when they shake your hand. It'll always be right hand to shake, and they'll never shake with their left. She's like, "Oh, I don't know if I could handle that." And I was like, "Well, you would get used to it very quickly." So the reality is that it's a you soon realize, what you can handle and what you can't. And but what you realize is you don't need much. You don't need much to survive. You need a simple diet, you need a place to put your head down, a little bit of a blanket, some people around you, and you can really do anything. So not easy, but rewarding is what I would say.
Absolutely, mate. Just want to acknowledge you, mate. Like that's an amazing story, and I know that you do have a video, so we'll make sure that we post that in the or when we promote this, put that in the links because I think that'll probably it'll help put the context to the story that you just told, and you'll be able to put in a I guess a visual sense, and it'll make a lot of or I think all the pieces will come together. So, mate, congratulations, and I know that you're going to continue to do so much more work. In Nepal, but it's just inspiring, man. I really, really appreciate it. And you're a good man.
Thank you, mate. Thanks for having me. And yeah, the video, just for your listeners, bear in mind the first half of the video is just the drive. I wanted to let people know, like, this is how hard it is to get to this place, rather than just skim over that bit. So, the video is pretty exciting at the beginning. So you're like, "Oh my God, look at this road."
Yeah,
But
man.
thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. And thanks for your listeners for listening in.
No worries, mate. Thanks for coming on telling the story.
Pleasure.